Welcome to State of the Bay. This is Grace Wan. On tonight's show, San Francisco public school teachers are on strike for the first time since 1979. We'll get the latest on what teachers and the district are fighting about and what this strike means for students and their families. How's the strike affecting you? Plus, concerns about kids and social media addiction have made their way into the courtroom. A lawsuit against YouTube and Meta argues that their platforms are designed to be addictive. Will this case hold tech companies accountable? And if you need a break from the headlines, we'll be talking to playwright Levi Holloway. His new play is Paranormal Activity. It's a story centered in the film franchise of the same name, and it's now on at ACT. Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. This hour, opening arguments began in the first-of-its-kind lawsuit against Meta and YouTube today. The plaintiffs contend that social media platforms are deliberately designed to be addictive for young users and that algorithms built to maximize engagement may be contributing to serious mental health issues. We'll break down what's being argued, why this case matters, and what accountability could look like as hundreds of similar lawsuits move forward. And later, we'll hear about the play Paranormal Activity, which is being staged at the American Conservatory Theater. If the headlines aren't scaring you enough, there's always theater. But first, San Francisco Unified School District teachers are on strike. Negotiations between district leaders and union officials broke down last week, and now families across the city are scrambling. Here to help us make sense of where talks stand and how we got here, we're joined by Jill Tucker, education reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Jill.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're also opening our phone lines early tonight because we'd love to hear from you. If you are a parent, a teacher, a student navigating the strike, how is it affecting you? How are you dealing with it? And maybe if you're a student, the day off was probably not a bad thing. You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Or you can find us on social media, Blue Sky, Instagram, and more. So, Jill, where are we? And before I begin, I should add one quick note. KALW station license is held by the district, but we do report independently. So let's talk about what the strike has looked like. The teachers hit the picket line today. Where are they gathering? Are they out there in front of their schools or in front of the district buildings?
Yeah, they hit the picket lines very early this morning, about a half an hour before the normal school bell would ring at each school site. And so they were out there 7:30, banging drums, chanting. And they were there for a good part of the morning, and then they all went over to Civic Center, had a huge rally, so it was the first day of the strike. Lots of enthusiasm among the teachers, lots of honking of cars, banging of drums, and as the two sides went into bargaining for the first time since Saturday, the teachers kind of dispersed, and that's where we are right now. Schools will be closed again tomorrow. We don't know exactly what's going to happen in bargaining tonight, but I think to give parents a good amount of time to make plans, the district announced that schools will be closed again tomorrow.
What are the core issues dividing the district and the union?
Yeah, the main issues really are raises and healthcare costs, and those are there. There are other issues having to do with special education and class sizes, some other things. But really, the main core issues really are the raises and the healthcare, especially for families. The healthcare costs for families have gone up for teachers from $1,200 to about $1,500. Healthcare is free for employees, but then once you go into the families, it gets pretty expensive. They want the district to pay full health care coverage for families, and the district has asked for a 9% raise over 2 years. The district has now offered the equivalent of a 6% raise over 2 years, and a health care amount each year, $24,000, that would cover essentially an employee plus one. Seems like they're pretty close, but really it hasn't been close enough to call off the strike, and it hasn't been close enough to get the two sides really in a place where it feels like They are bargaining in a polite way. It still feels very, very tense.
You know, this is a school district that has been facing a lot of financial problems. The superintendent is Maria Sue. Before her, Matt Wayne was contending with a payroll system that literally wasn't paying the teachers because it was just not working. Does the district have the money to offer what the teachers are demanding?
Yeah, the district has been in a fiscal crisis for many, many, many years. They have been overspending. And they have a large deficit. They had to cut $114 million this past year. And the state was so concerned about the district's financial status that they appointed state advisors who still at this point have oversight to overspending, school board spending. So they can actually veto any spending that the school board approves if they think that it could contribute to the district's fiscal insolvency. And that includes a contract with a labor group. So even if the district approves or agrees to a contract, if the fiscal advisors think that it would be cost prohibitive, they could veto it. So the district really is in financial straits, and they are deficit spending. It really comes down to the union. There is a pot of money. It's sort of a reserve amount of money that the union wants the district to spend to pay for the raises, to pay for the healthcare costs. But it's kind of it's a one-time pot of money, and a lot of it's for reserved uses. It's kind of earmarked. But it would run out. And so the district does not want to agree to long-term costs like raises or healthcare, knowing that money would run out, and then they would have to make cuts to pay for those things in the future.
It's no surprise. It's very difficult to be a teacher, a public school teacher, given the rate of pay. I mean, and it's just unaffordable to live in the city on a teacher's salary. But what was it that caused the situation to boil over this time? I mean, because these are not new factors.
Yeah, I think there is... you know, it's been a variety of things. I think in general, you know, when we look at the economy of the state, when we look at the ongoing deficit for many, many districts, which has been exacerbated by declining enrollment across the state in districts, including San Francisco, there's just less money for districts to spend. The vast majority are looking to make cuts. And trying to pay teachers more, trying to deal with healthcare costs. Pension costs, for example, for the teachers have gone from the equivalent of 8% of salary to 21% of salary. So all of these increasing costs with declining enrollment are just stretching budgets really, really thin. Mm-hmm. And so districts across the state are trying to figure out how to pay for all of these things when their money is getting tighter. And so I think to a certain degree, this year after the pandemic money has run out, I think they're sending a message. You're seeing these strikes and districts coming to impasse across the state. This is not just San Francisco. And we're seeing sort of this trend of the frustration coming to a boiling point.
What have we heard from the governor in terms of adding more funding, or the state superintendent in terms of putting more money into the budget so these districts have more money to spend on their teachers? Anything?
No, you know, not really. The funding formula for schools in Prop 98 to a large degree dictates how much money is spent on education. It's pretty large part of the state budget. Of course, the governor and the legislature could always allocate more, and sometimes they do. Right now, the federal government is not pushing a lot of money into schools. In fact, it's cut back a significant amount of money that has been spent on research and other types of things. And so it really is an issue with districts worried about, too, the future of the federal government funding for a variety of things. Including low-income students and English learners, and the state also looking at the economy and what's going to happen in the future. So really, no one is expecting a really big increase from the state. Although they'd like to see that for sure.
Of course. Well, the mayor has no control over the school district, but invariably people look to City Hall for leadership. What has Mayor Lurie said about the strike?
Yeah, he has become increasingly frustrated, he said, with the lack of 24/7 bargaining, really. He has urged both sides to stay at the table until they come to a deal. He asked the union to delay the strike for a few days so that they could try to work out a deal after they made some progress on Saturday. The union declined. So he really has been trying to wield his authority and his you know, the mayor's office to get the two sides to stay at the table till they reach a deal so that the kids could get back to school. So far, that hasn't really worked. They were bargaining until Saturday evening, and then they didn't get back to the table till this afternoon.
Well, you know, obviously teachers are affected by their, you know, for the demands that they're making, but this is really falling on to families and students. I mean, for students who get their school lunches through the school, and that's like a major meal for them, are they still able to get that that lunch, that breakfast, or is that closed off as well?
Well, the schools were closed, but the city stepped up and the Department of Children, Youth and Families had meal distribution sites scattered at dozens of sites across the city. Today, we had some folks at a couple of the sites. It weren't a lot of people showing up. They only had a few dozen meals at some of the sites. So it was first come, first served basis. So we're going to get a count and see how many families took advantage of that. You know, but it's one of those things like day one, everybody's like, maybe it's just one day. Right. Mm-hmm. And we can make do. The longer this goes on, the need obviously will be much greater. And, you know, we're not quite sure how long the city will be able to provide these types of services. They said that they, too, do not have a lot of money to throw into these types of resources. So it really just depends on how long the strike drags on. But at least for today and tomorrow, these meals will be made available at many, many sites across the city. And we have a list on our website, yes. And so does the city.
Yeah, so people should look for that. I mean, for kids who are, you know, this is the time of year you're supposed to be doing your classes and getting ready for your tests. Are there resources that the district is giving out for families to keep their kids on track academically?
Well, kind of. They had packets available, you know, independent learning packets available. But, you know, the packets were, you know, more occupying time type of packets, not necessarily instructional type packets. I know, you know, kids obviously have homework that they probably could be doing for their classes, you know, for some of the older kids. You know, I think the idea is that everybody's crossing their fingers that this won't be a super long strike. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the older kids, as one mom told me, this sort of feels like a snow day for them. And they don't usually get them in San Francisco. So, everybody's kind of, you know, thinking of this as short term and crossing their fingers. I think if it does drag on, it's going to feel a little bit more like a lot of learning loss, a lot of services that they're missing. And it's going to feel a lot more desperate.
I mean, shades of COVID, you know, the height of COVID, that's what it feels like.
Oh, my gosh. That's what I heard more today from families than anything else, that they really were having flashbacks to the parents, that they were having that anxiety and that stress of the school being closed and not knowing when it was going to open again.
It's the PTSD. It keeps coming back. I predict a lot of yes, it's a lot of Bluey and Khan Academy happening in people's houses.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
yeah.
As this goes on, we'll have to bring you back. But thank you so much. That was Jill Tucker.
Let's not say as it goes on. Let's just say going to end soon. And,
okay.
And we'll never have to talk again about
I hope we never have to talk to you again about this. Let's manifest that, Jill. That was Jill Tucker, education reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the social media's big tobacco moment? Stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Social media companies are facing a legal challenge unlike any they've seen before, one that could fundamentally change how these platforms are designed for young users. Opening arguments began today in LA in the first of a series of closely watched trials that argue social media itself is a defective product, one that is responsible for real-world harm to children and teens. Two companies, TikTok and Snap, have already settled, but Meta and YouTube are heading to court, where judges and juries will be asked to weigh questions of addiction, personal injury, and corporate responsibility. This hour, we'll look to see how these cases differ from past attempts to regulate tech, what plaintiffs say companies knew about the risks to kids, and what a win or a loss may mean for both social media and AI use it with young people. Joining us are Lauren Feiner. She is a senior policy reporter at The Verge, and she covers the intersection of Silicon Valley and Capitol Hill. Welcome to State of the Bay, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Sasha Haworth. She's the executive director of the Tech Oversight Project, a nonprofit tech watchdog focused on advancing meaningful tech reform nationwide. Welcome, Sasha.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Are you a parent of a young person on social media? How have those platforms affected your child? Or are you an adult or a young adult who feels like you are addicted to social media? You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We're also on social media and more. So Lauren, let's start with the basics. Who is the plaintiff in this case and what are they alleging?
Yeah, so the plaintiff in this case is a 19-year-old going by the initials KGM, who is alleging that essentially she was using social media platforms like Meta and YouTube, and that their addictive features brought her back to the platforms over and over again and facilitated later mental health harms that she struggled with. So this is just one of many cases that allege similar things, but this is the first that we're seeing go to trial.
And Lauren, when you say Meta, you're talking about the plaintiff is talking specifically about Instagram, or is it also Facebook?
Yeah, I believe it's mainly Instagram, but yeah, Meta owns both Instagram and Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Sasha, what makes this case in LA different from previous lawsuits brought against social media companies? Are there new arguments being made against them, or is there new research that we know about the addictive nature of these apps?
Yeah, what makes them different is that the approach has been to treat these companies like the big tobacco of our day, which of course, I believe this trial will prove that they are. They're product liability cases. They go after not the content that they allege Meta or Google or TikTok or Snap are showing to people and alleging harms based on that, but they are actually attacking the algorithms and the designs of the products. They were designed to be addictive. The companies did that deliberately, and they knew that it was harmful, and they failed to alert the public to that. So that's for the first time. These companies have been heretofore protected by what's colloquially known as Section 230, which is an immunity shield. It's basically protected them from litigation. And with this product liability approach that the plaintiffs have taken, they can evade that shield.
Mm. Well, Lauren, I know from my own personal experience, I have bed rotted by going through Instagram just. Get it. I mean, there was a point where I really did firmly believe I needed a new pair of black loafers with lug soles just because Instagram kept telling me that. So maybe I think that there is an addictive quality. But tell me, how are these products, if we're going to call them products versus apps, built to be addictive?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all been there just scrolling through these apps yes. over and over again. I think, you know, it's clear that, you know, companies are, especially companies that are funded by advertisers, like Instagram, for example, are trying to keep users engaged on the platform. And what the plaintiffs in these cases say is basically they're doing that to a detrimental degree basically just to pad their own profits. But I think when we talk about social media addiction, it can be tricky because, you know, on the one hand, we all, I think, can understand how sticky these products are, how they keep us coming back. On the other hand, I think we'll hear tech companies argue, like I actually heard Meta argue in a separate trial in New Mexico today, that, you know, saying the word addiction, it's not really the same as like when we're talking about addiction to an illegal substance like fentanyl, for example, that, you know, it does something different in your brain than an actual illicit substance might do. So I think there's these competing ideas about what actually qualifies as addiction that we'll see play out in these trials.
Well, Sasha, I mean, one very remarkable thing that has happened in these trials is there's a process called discovery in which each side has to give up documents, internal documents sometimes. And in this case, there are thousands of pages of internal documents from these companies that are shockingly revealing. What do they say?
Oh my gosh, there are millions of pages of evidence that have become unsealed even before opening statements today, which showed even more that we hadn't seen before. And, you know, you brought up addiction. It's not just advertisements that make these apps, these products addictive. It's features like infinite scroll, autoplay, push notifications that this trial is going to go into is extremely effective on kids and teens with underdeveloped brains, right? And furthermore, it's don't just take my word for it. Meta commissioned a study with Nielsen to determine what happened when teenagers or other users stopped using their apps for a week or more. At the end of the week, the users reported they felt happier. They were not exhibiting compulsive behavior. They didn't feel like they had to pick up their phone and log on. They felt their mental health was better. Instead of publishing that document and alerting the public to the harm of their product, they buried it. And that's one of the internal documents that has become, that has come to light because of this trial. And in fact, don't even take my word for it. When I call them Big Tobacco, they referred to themselves as Big Tobacco.
Wow.
Another internal doc showed an exchange between two Instagram engineers referring to them as basically drug pushers, the way that they were pushing Instagram on teens, and joking about this very Nielsen study that they commissioned proving addiction, asking one another somewhat rhetorically, will this make us look like Big Tobacco if we commission this study and then bury it? So those two alone, I think, are the true heart of the trial and why I think this is going to be horrifically damaging for big tech companies. Today we saw a YouTube internal presentation showing a photo of like a four-year-old with a teddy bear talking about how parents want to rely on an app to be a digital babysitter. They want to trust that they can leave their kid alone with the app to be entertained. And Meta even created something that they called internally Project Mist, where they surveyed over 1,000 teens and their parents about social media use. And it showed that at the end of the day, the children who had gone through the most trauma and the most stress were particularly vulnerable for addiction, and that parental supervision and the controls that Meta allegedly implemented to protect kids online were useless.
Wow. Well, this is State of the Bay on 91.7 KALW FM, San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm Grace Wan. Tonight, we're digging into a series of closely watched lawsuits that could reshape how social media companies design their products for kids and teens. We're joined by Lauren Feiner. She's a senior policy reporter at The Verge, and Sasha Hayworth. She's the executive director of the Tech Oversight Project. And we want to hear from you. Are you a young person navigating social media right now? Have you seen its impacts, positive or negative, on your life? Are you the parent parent of a young person, and do you feel that your young person may be exhibiting signs of addiction to social media? You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@klw.org or find us on social media, Instagram, Blue Sky, and more. We're at State of the Bay. We have a comment here from a listener who writes, "We're parents of a middle schooler and a high schooler, and it feels like social media is everywhere. If these platforms really are addictive by design, what should families be doing right now while these cases play out? What should our schools be doing?" You know, Lauren, I mean, I think it's an interesting dilemma because it's placed in the hands of parents. And I recall, you know, reporting a few years ago where people who work in tech were saying, well, we don't let our kids use this. I mean, that's like, we're not putting this in front of our children. I mean, so are you irresponsible as a parent if you let your kid have access to this social media product?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really tricky decision for parents to make. And I think it's really a personal decision and maybe a community-based decision to make. You know, I know that in some communities, there's pledges not to give kids a phone or access to social media until eighth grade. And that's the sort of thing that's easier to do if you have a lot of people in your community banding together to do the same thing so that your child isn't the one left out. So I think, you know, there are things you can do, you know, try and limit time or have, you know, certain boundaries on where and when these platforms can be used. But, you know, I think it's fair to acknowledge it can be really tricky when you know, a phone is something you can have in your pocket, and it's really easy to just get a hold of these platforms a lot of the time. Mm.
You know, Sasha, before there was, you know, the social media apps, Instagram and the like, you know, people would just brain rot themselves in front of a television and just scroll endlessly over the 200 channels they have. How is that any different from what people are doing today on an app? I mean, it's the same kind of idea. I mean, it's not as if, or maybe they did. Did anybody ever allege that TV is addictive and harmful for health?
I think maybe in some political debates, perhaps, but mm-hmm. not successfully in any case. No, I mean, I think, and look, I'm not a neuroscientist or a psychologist, but I know that there is something much, much different to holding a thing in your hand, having it at your fingertips, infinite knowledge right at your fingertips. It's giving you push notifications every time your friend, a stranger, likes your post or sends, you know, a DM or whatever. A television, you have to make the decision to turn it on. And a television sits in the living room. And as a parent, I have two young boys. I know that all I have to do is hide the remote. And at some point, maybe they'll figure out all my hiding spots. But, you know, I can control that. The most insidious thing about social media use amongst kids and teens is that a kid can take their phone into their room and the parent won't know what they're watching, who they're talking to, who's talking to them. And sadly, I think, there are a lot of cases where children have been preyed upon, mm-hmm. Sextorted through social media. And as far as I know, that has not happened through a television set.
Right. Well, I also think that, you know, you could take away a kid's phone, but if you have a tablet, if you have a computer, you still have access to these apps. They're not unique to the phone itself. But Sasha, I was curious because we were talking earlier about the internal research that's come to light because of these lawsuits. And in one of them, the meta researchers that you referenced are talking about something that the quote is, "We are causing reward deficit disorder because people are binging on Instagram or IG so much they can't feel reward anymore." And in that case, the researcher concluded that the user's addiction was both biological and psychological, which the company seemed to want to exploit that dynamic. What do we know about this reward deficit disorder? Is it a real thing?
I mean, if it certainly, again, I'm not a psychologist, but yes, it certainly seems to be real given the fact that we have now entered a court of law where Meta and Google and Snapchat and TikTok will have to prove That they didn't knowingly addict kids based off of the internal data that they've been able to collect, that the studies that they've commissioned, that the actual psychologists and the actual neuroscientists that they hired to study kids' brains to determine how best to target them as an audience, that is something that that these trials are going to be are going to bring to light. I mean, you know, the best parent in the world cannot compete with the power of an algorithm that is created by the most powerful company in the world. Their entire business model is to attract a younger and younger audience. And in fact, they some of the evidence unveiled at trial has referenced that as well.
Yeah. Lauren, in this case and the other kind of the companion cases, are they class actions? Like if the plaintiff here wins, will everybody, is there a class of individuals who will benefit?
Yeah, it's a great question because this is kind of an unusual structure, one that maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with. It's not a class action. So in a class action, you'd have a decision reached at the end of the trial, and then that would apply to everyone who's part of the class, and everyone would get kind of a similar payout as a result of that. Maybe you've gotten those emails that look like spam. Mm. But this is different because this is what they call a bellwether trial. So even though a lot of these cases have been consolidated for the purposes of going through different stages of the trial proceedings before trial, the cases remain individual. So each case is going to be litigated as its own entity, and the outcome of that case doesn't affect the outcome of any of the other cases in that group. And basically, there's a few bellwether trials, and once they get through those, if they don't all settle, the idea is that ultimately there should be what's called a global settlement, where basically the parties would decide, okay, we're going to settle the remainder of these cases, and here's how we're going to do it. And at that stage, they would have more information based on how the bellwether cases went, because they'd have an understanding of what are the sorts of claims that juries are amenable to in ruling on.
Well, Lauren, what does the plaintiff in this case want? Is it money to help repair the damage that this person has experienced? Is it shutting down these apps entirely?
Yeah, I believe that in this case, they're seeking both monetary damages and for changes to the apps themselves. They really want to see changes to how these platforms are designed in ways that they feel like have had harmful consequences on them.
Yeah, and what would that be? Like no more infinite scroll or?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit early to say, but I think that something like that is probably on the right track. Certain changes that would, you know, at least in their view, make the platforms less addictive or, you know, less sticky to come back to.
This is State of the Bay on 91.7 KALW. I'm Grace Wan. We're talking about the legal battle over whether social media platforms can be held responsible for harm to young users and what's at stake if these cases move forward. Do you think that social media companies should be held liable for how their products affect kids? And what safeguards would you like to see put in place? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. One listener writes, I'm in my early 20s and grew up on Instagram and YouTube. While I wouldn't call it an addiction, I do feel like these apps changed and continue to influence how I focus and sleep. Sasha, you know, the focus here is on younger kids and younger teens, but there's certainly a generation out there that grew up on these apps. Maybe they're in their early 20s now, and they might feel like they are experiencing some of the negativity of what social media offers. I mean, do we know anything about the long-term effects of things like this reward deficit disorder and all the other negative aspects of social media?
No, I mean, that's the terrifying part, Grace. We don't know.
I'm literally going to throw my phone away after this conversation.
I mean, you'd be just like Mark Zuckerberg because he doesn't give his kids a phone.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, the first plaintiff in this case, initials KGM, she is now 20. She was 17 when she filed the lawsuit, I believe, and Lauren, fact check me if I'm wrong, but she created her first social media account at age 9.
Wow.
Studies are just starting to come out about the long-term effects of social media use. Researchers are not given access to what industry has access to on the back end. And I just read a report that showed that unfortunately most public studies are commissioned by industry, which of course, speaking of big tobacco, is one way to sort of pad your side of things in the public. But social scientists like Jonathan Haidt have written about this. Famously, he wrote a book called The Anxious Generation, which I know is kind of having a moment right now, because I think a lot of parents like myself are really concerned about our kids. The Generation Alpha, Gen Z are experiencing really high rates of depression. Their mental health is suffering. They're socially isolated. And, you know, COVID had a lot to do with that. But what were they doing when they were home, homeschooled because of COVID? Well, they were on their phones. That's where their friends were. And it doesn't seem like they've really bounced back from that time. Studies have shown they're also having less sex. They're not getting in relationships as much. I do think that's probably one outcome of a whole generation that has been brought up on social media. And I know that a lot of young folks are kind of swearing off.
Yeah. Well, what, Lauren, are the companies saying? I mean, we know that two companies, TikTok and Snap, have settled. But what are Meta and YouTube, which is owned by Google, saying about their products?
Yeah, I mean, I think the companies generally say that they really do what they can to mitigate risks to users. And they say that they don't design their platforms to be addictive to kids and teens, and that they actually build in certain features that try to get them to spend less time on social media at certain hours or encourage them to take time off. So I think the companies are going to get up there and argue that they do take precautions to limit the sort of compulsive use behaviors, and that, you know, the fact that they do research even when it's behind closed doors or sometimes it leaks out, shows that, they do try to get an understanding of what kinds of harms their users might be experiencing so that they can mitigate it.
Could I say something about that too?
Yeah,
guys?
Of course, please.
I think that's why this trial is going to be such a watershed moment. I really do believe that once Mark Zuckerberg has to testify before a jury of his peers, he's a billionaire, so he doesn't hang out with regular people very often. So that's going to be an eye-opening moment for him in many ways. But it's going to show that despite their public positions and what they have told Congress many times, that namely that they work to protect children, they got safeguards, their very own internal documents, their slide decks, their internal text messages, their presentation, they reveal that young children, even younger than 13, which is the oldest you have to be in order to have an Instagram account, were their target audience. And so it's just going to be a seminal moment in history. I also know that what they're going to say about the victims here, they've already started today. They victim shame, just like they do with, you know, any whistleblower that comes out, whether or not they're even still employees. There are going to be whistleblowers testifying at this trial as well. Of course, every whistleblower that has released a report, from Frances Haugen all the way to just this year, is a, quote, disgruntled employee. And I don't think it will come as a shock that they've said this girl had social media, or I'm sorry, had mental health issues before she even had a social media account. Well, like, again, she created her first account at 9 years old, so I'm not quite sure what evidence they have of that. So I do expect that they will try to undermine the credibility of both the plaintiffs here, the victim plaintiffs, and also any expert whistleblowers that are going to testify.
Lauren, I mean, on one side you have, you know, billionaires and trillion-dollar companies, Google and Meta, as defendants who have unlimited sums of money. And then on the other hand, you have a 20-year-old plaintiff. How is she going forward with this case? I mean, is she getting funding from someplace else? Because this has got to be extremely expensive.
That's a good question. I'm not positive about the funding of all of this, but I know that it's, you know, this is a kind of case that, you know, a lot of parents, advocacy groups, many people have been wanting to bring for a while. So I'm sure there's a lot of support for this kind of litigation to be brought.
We have a listener who writes, I'm struggling with the idea of blaming tech companies for all of these mental health issues in kids. The world is very different today from the one in which I grew up. How will these cases prove the anxiety and depression are attributable to social media instead of climate change, increasing expectations on our youth, sociopolitical divides, economic uncertainty, etc.? I mean, Sasha, that is one of the hurdles that the plaintiff will need to get over, as we were talking about. The defendants may begin by, you know, blaming the victim here, but even just showing that causation between I have an Instagram account and it makes me feel a certain way versus it's caused me to have, you know, suicide ideation or depression or whatnot. Do we expect there's going to be a lot of medical testimony and expert testimony on that?
Yes, exactly. There'll be the preeminent scholars and experts on mental health, on addiction, on, I think, on children specifically as well at trial. So they are much more qualified to speak about, you know, the intricacies of that. I think what another, this is just, you know, mental health, the sort of depression, pro eating disorder behavior, all of that is one part of the trial, but there are also sextortion cases, right? I mean, you could pretty well argue that a child would not have been approached by a child predator if Facebook did not have a 17-strike policy for would-be pedophiles as their policy before kicking them off, right? So if they weren't able to reach out to a child on social media, that child would likely never had to go through that trauma. It's also about what the companies knew and when they knew it, right? They knew that their products were designed to addict children and teens, and they knew that these products also had this type of effect on children and teens, and they failed to tell the public about it. That's what's at stake here. They have a duty of care, it's known in the policy community. It's they, you know, we require, and you asked earlier about what could the outcome be about some of these cases. Well, you know, there's attorneys general are watching this, lawmakers around the world are watching this, and I think they're getting ideas for how to change policy and require companies to just be a little better. I mean, we don't design a playground without running it through safety standards. You know, every time you pick up a pill bottle and you have to, like, you know, activate arthritis in order to open it, that's there to protect the children, a child, in the event that they pick up that pill bottle. Because, like that's what we're asking is simply design your products in a way that don't hurt kids.
Well, we'll
If I
have to
could
leave it
just.
there for now. We've run out of time, but it's something fascinating to keep an eye on. My guests tonight were Lauren Feiner. She's a senior policy reporter at The Verge. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We also had Sasha Haworth, executive director of the Tech Oversight Project. Sasha, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear about the ACT's new play, followed by our weekly news quiz. Stay with us.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. If you enjoy the occasional scary movie and you also enjoy live theater, you won't want to miss ACT's upcoming production of Paranormal Activity. It's an adaptation for the stage of the horror movie franchise under the same name. And tonight we have the writer and the mind behind it, Levi Holloway. Thank you so much for being on State of the Bay, Levi.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great.
Well, tell us about this production. Most theater goers don't necessarily expect to be frightened in their seats. What drew you to adapt this scary story for the stage?
Well, it landed on my desk and I was surprised because it seemed like an impossible task to adapt horror for the stage. So I was curious about that. It felt like a dare. And then when I found out who was attached to direct, it was a no-brainer. A guy named Felix Barrett, who I'm a huge fan of. Founder and artistic director of Punch Drunk Theater Company. He did Sleep No More. And we met and we talked about our shared tastes when it comes to all things horror, both in film and fiction. And we just hit it off. And creating this work with him and with our design team has been a lot of fun. It's a lot of mischief and a lot of delight. So yeah, it's great.
Well, that's exciting. And what can you tell us about the storyline?
Yeah, it is a story unattached to the film franchise. It's about James and Lou. They are newly married and they hooked up in Chicago and something went awry in Chicago. And they've got this opportunity to move overseas to London for work. And they've taken that opportunity for a fresh start. And they find themselves in this new strange place, strangers in a strange land. And they discover pretty quickly that what troubled them in Chicago has traveled with them abroad. And that it's not that the places that they've been in are haunted. It's they themselves as people that are haunted. You can't run from yourself.
And I understand that the play opened in London in December and has been extended twice already. Congratulations on that. And does the production change from city to city? Did you have to make tweaks for a London audience, given that the play takes place in London, or did it fit right at home there?
It seems to fit pretty well. London audiences are great, and it's been very warmly received. And I haven't found that there's been too much of a culture shock, no matter where we are. I'll say that as a writer that's always in the room, in the rehearsal space, I'm constantly tweaking the volleys between characters. It depends on who's playing these parts and what are their voices and who are they as humans. So we're constantly shifting the texture of the piece. And that's been really exciting. But wholesale, it remains true to what we started with.
And what does live theater allow you to do with fear that film maybe doesn't?
Well, I think film, because it can play with editing and sequencing and manipulates the eye in a different way, you know, it's its own thing. Theater doesn't have those luxuries. It has a lot of its own. A huge one for me has been the community that theater builds there in the dark and that shared experience with your neighbors and the sort of rolling contagious nerves that happen as they watch the show. That's a huge part of it because a huge character in the play is the audience. And it's a single set. It's set in a two-story home designed by an incredible designer named Fly Davis. And because it's this open-faced sandwich, you have access to every room as an audience member. So while maybe there's some action happening downstairs in the kitchen, the couple may be talking about something, your eye might drift up to the second story, maybe in the bathroom, and maybe there's a piece of storytelling there.
What's it like watching the audiences react? Do you ever wonder if you've gone too far? Are they nervous? Are they laughing? Are they screaming? What are they doing?
it's my favorite thing. As we're creating the piece, you know, we'll have previews and invite a dress, and we'll sit there, the creative team and myself, and we'll just be delighted with the impact that the show will have. No, I don't worry that I've gone too far. I could always go further. You know, I'm kind of messed up like that. Horror is not, there's no one way through. You know, it's personal to everybody. And so people having that shared experience is really delightful and something that's lost in your home in front of the screen.
I would imagine the demographic for theaters skews a little older than the demographic for horror movies. Are you relying on pacemakers to keep everybody safe during these performances?
I think a great piece of marketing would be that we killed somebody, but the pockets don't necessarily agree. I'm just kidding. We are bringing new audiences into the theater. I think film-going audiences, slightly younger demographic people are there who maybe have never seen a play before. And that's the kind of chatter that gets really exciting. But I think the play itself passes the smell test for the more discerning audience. It's a good piece of theater. It's a good story.
Well, I can't wait to see it. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. But Levi Holloway is the playwright of Paranormal Activity. It opens at the Tony Renby Theater in San Francisco, February 19th. You can get your tickets from a link on our website. Levi, thank you so much for appearing on State of the Bay. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me. Same.
I'm Chris Nooney, and this is week two of State of the Bay's Local News Quiz. Each week, we'll ask you a few questions about news stories you might have heard on KALW throughout the week. We'll post the answers on our website after the show airs. You can email us to let us know how you did and whether you're enjoying this new feature. We're at stateofthebay@klw.org. So let's get to it. Football fever hit the Bay Area last week with the New England Patriots and the Seattle Seahawks facing off in Super Bowl 60 at Levi's Stadium yesterday. I'm going to ask you three Super Bowl-related questions. Don't worry if you aren't a sports fan. They're not all about football. We're going to start with an easy one. This year's Super Bowl halftime headliner just made Grammy history as the first artist to win Album of the Year with an all-Spanish album. Who is it? Here's a musical clue. Next up, the Bay Area has hosted the Super Bowl before. The last time was in 2016 when the Denver Broncos beat the Carolina Panthers. But can you name the year the Bay Area first hosted a Super Bowl? And for bonus points, where was that first game held? Not Levi's Stadium. That didn't open until 2014. Want to know who won that game?
San Francisco! 49!
Yup, the Niners won their second Super Bowl title that year, and three more would follow within the next decade. Okay, last Super Bowl question. If you live in San Francisco, you may have noticed a low-flying helicopter in the sky last week. Your question, what was that helicopter doing? Believe it or not, it is related to the Super Bowl. That's it for today's news quiz. Join us next week for three new questions about what's happening around the Bay Area.
And that's State of the Bay this week. I hope you don't need a pacemaker to finish that quiz. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners for the evening and for being part of the conversation. We're off next Monday for President's Day, but tune in on February 23rd at 6 for more live and local conversations about Bay Area life, culture, and politics. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Ann Harper. The last segment was engineered by Devon Strolovich, and Tariq Ansari was our board operator. Coming up next is an episode of the Your Call series, The Authoritarian Playbook. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.